We Can Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is free and available now for iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.
T-10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
We Can Confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Ready or not, folks, it is December now, last month of the year, and this is the last month of Weekend Confirm's second big season. How do you like that?
Yeah, we were talking before we started recording about how close we are to Back to the Future's future. Back to the Future 2's future. It was like 2015 or something.
It's almost here. You have your betting book ready?
Yeah. Yeah, I wish. My almanac. Your almanac.
So you can hand it off to your secret
self, my former self.
That's right. That's Jeff Drake Kanata here next to me.
Yeah, if only. Of course, Drake spelled with two N's and one T.
Right, absolutely. If you're wondering why I'm saying that, Jeff's rocking the Nathan Drake look today. He's got the sand Bedouin look going on.
It's my awesome. Girlfriend dressed me, so.
Wait, dude, you dress well anyway.
I don't, actually. Well. That's why I need her.
When did this turn into the details podcast?
You're a handsome.
What are you wearing today, Zev?
Oh, well, this is, I don't even know.
Andrew would approve.
Andrew would approve. Andrew would approve of that look. Andrew Yoon, best dressed man in video game.
Andrew Yoon was wearing this look like 15 years ago.
He came out of the womb looking like that.
He's like, what are we going to do with you, Jeff? What are we going to do with you? Anyway, yes, this is We Can Confirm. That is Zav D'Amatos from ShackNews.com down there at the other end of the table.
Always a pleasure, gentlemen.
I guess we're all from, well, you're not from Shack News. I'm from ShackNews.com. I'm a Shacker.
You are a Shacker.
There you go. Hey, what do we got coming up on the show today? Well, it's past the big release time, so we're catching up on stuff. I've been playing some Uncharted 3. Jeff won't tell me what he's been playing. It's a secret.
It's a surprise. What's different than a secret? It's a surprise.
Yeah, he's been dancing around. I know something. I'll
tell you right now.
If you think that we know what game is, maybe you can describe it and we can try to guess the game that you're talking about.
It's a game that I've gotten dozens and dozens and dozens of tweet requests for me to try.
Tetris?
Really? And I've never tried it. Very close. You're very close. You don't know how close you are.
Puzzle Sumo. Fighter?
No. It's not
Geometry Wars?
Well, it does deal with geometry.
Okay.
Do you want me to tell you what it is? Can you guess?
Clax.
Guys, you ready for this?
Are you ready? Are you going to spill the beans now?
I don't think either of you guys have played it. Maybe Zav.
Mm.
Minecraft.
Oh, gosh.
Oh,
my goodness.
I am hooked.
Really?
Oh, what?
Sucked in.
All right, hold on. We're rearranging the entire show now because he's already done. We're going to talk about some other stuff later on. We got news. There's some patch for Skyrim to mess things up. Anyway, Minecraft. What the hell?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Now, okay, so let me just set the scene a little bit in that obviously Minecraft is a huge deal.
Yes.
And we've never really talked about it on this show.
I
got to admit, I kind of avoided it. I think I have sort of a prejudice against things that stay in beta forever. I've gotten to the point where I don't really want to participate in betas anymore. Like, I haven't even really been playing the Star Wars beta. Like, I just, let me know when it's done,
right,
and I'll try it then.
Yeah.
Because I got other stuff I can play that's done.
In those situations, it's different because you work really hard and then you lose everything
exactly
when the game starts. But Minecraft, I don't think, does that.
But it doesn't. And beta is sort of even a kind of a misnomer for what it was, right? But
I would agree with that.
I just sort of avoided it, and it was such a huge deal. And so many people were saying, you got to play it, you got to play it.
Yep.
And I think the reason that people were saying that to me specifically is because I have such a vocal love of Lego.
Right.
And of course, the easy comparison is to Lego.
Okay.
But I also kind of felt like, I mean, I've had the experience with Little Big Planet and some of the other like create a world things where I was like, you know, I love the fact that people do it, but I don't want to be the guy that does it.
It's interesting because you have the opposite sort of reaction to people who argue that Skyrim's story is like create your own story.
Yeah, I know. I'm very inconsistent that way on a number of topics. But I just kind of avoided it. And that was it was a fault of mine because I didn't really understand it. I didn't understand where the game was.
Right.
I thought it was all just, you know, building a Lego world, which admittedly, I find very cool.
I actually have not played it, and I was surprised to hear about things. I thought it was basically you just make your own thing.
Yeah.
And then I hear things about, like, there are enemies that attack you, yeah, and villagers that are coming into the game soon, yeah, and like and dragons are being added to the game. And I was
how does that work? As well, that if, like, if you're writing the hate mail to me, would you like a little more return? It was a little loud to me at first.
I think you're adjusting me.
Was I adjusting you?
Great radio.
Is that better?
Great radio. Yes.
Before you, like, finish writing that post of, I hate Garnet, why is he trolling Minecraft? I wasn't trolling it. I was more confessing my utter ignorance to the game.
As am I.
And like, my acceptance of the fact that I realized way too late how big Minecraft was getting.
Yeah.
And it was positively daunting to me. And
yeah,
rather than piddle with it a little bit and be that guy who's like trying to talk about something that he has no fucking clue about, I said, you know what? I'm not going there right now.
That's exactly the same mea culpa that I wanted to put out there first. Like, I didn't understand it, and I didn't take the time to try to understand it. I just kind of assumed I knew what it was about and avoided it.
Right.
So could you bring me up to speed a little bit on what exactly
okay,
it is then?
Okay, so here's the wonderful thing about Minecraft. And again, a majority of our audience is going to be like, yawn, we all know about this for the last however many years.
That's exactly how all of our audience
but
sounds.
I'm sure there's a number of people who are like myself who just didn't understand what it was.
Right.
And it's all about survival mode. So what happens is you load up a server, right? And it randomly generates a world.
Okay.
And you are thrust into that world with nothing. You have nothing. You're just a dude, right? But there's a lot of bad things in that world. But the bad things in that world only come out at night. And the day and night cycle is very quick. So you have a limited amount of time in the daytime to get your shit together. Because the bad stuff is coming out. And the bad stuff is bad. It's going to get you. There's
really
creepers and spiders and all kinds of stuff. Like, guys that will come up next to you and just explode, taking terrain with them and killing you.
Okay.
Right? And you have to keep yourself alive and you have to keep yourself fed. Because if you have the maximum, if your food meter is maxed out, then you regenerate health.
Okay.
So it instantly becomes Survivor Man or whatever reality show you want to reference.
Man versus Minecraft?
Man versus Minecraft.
Okay.
Because the game is really built on a very elegant crafting model that I had no idea about until I played it.
Hence the name.
I mean, you literally mine and you craft. So it's not just a Warcraft, Starcraft ripoff. It literally is very descriptive of what you do.
Okay.
And you have a bunch of raw materials depicted in your world. You have trees that have wood in them. You have granite and stone and, you know, you have iron and all kinds of material. And you have little, like, cows and pigs wandering around that you can slaughter for food. And you can craft a certain amount of stuff just on your person. You can, take those raw materials and craft them into certain things. But then the real key is when you build your workbench, because your workbench opens up your crafting possibilities. And the way it does that is you have a very small grid in your inventory, and then you can place things into that grid in certain formations. And depending on the material and the formation, that defines what you create. And by building a workbench, you're getting a larger grid so okay. You can create more elaborate formations. And the brilliant thing about how this game is set up is that all the formations are very intuitive. They look like what you think it might look like. Like, do you want to make some pants out of yourself for yourself? Well, throw some leather in a little two-leg shape with a belt across the top. You know, basically an upside-down U. It looks like pants, so you make pants. You want to build stairs out of the stone that you've got? Make a little stair-looking thing, and it makes stairs. It's beautiful, and there are thousands of combinations and different materials that you can throw in there. Do you want to make a bow and arrow? Well, you chop some wood, so you have raw wood.
Okay.
You convert that wood into wood slats, or I can't remember what it's called, like timber, basically. Then you can convert timber into sticks, and then you take sticks and you make them into a C shape. And you have to kill spiders to get their string. And then you put a string in the space between the C so it looks like a bow and arrow. And that creates a bow and arrow.
7 hours later, you have a bow.
7 hours later. All the while,
Day-night
the sun's going okay. down. Bad things are coming. You got to get food. You got to get shelter. So that's all just the sort of the context of what okay. you're doing. The real fun, and I kind of understood that, oh, you're going to build shit. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The real fun comes in. I'm here. Oh, shit. I got to dig a hole. I got to dig a hole and hide myself into it because surviving the first night is what it's all about. You got to get a hole, seal it up. So you want to get yourself a pick as soon as you can, which is cool because it's a stick and stones across the top, right? And makes a pick. You can make a wood pick. You can make a stone pick. You can make an iron pick. You can make a gold pick, whatever.
Toothpick.
So you can dig into the ground. You make your little hidey hole, seal it back up. Try to avoid the bad guys, right? That's the first night. Okay, I just made it through the first night. Go out during the day, and then you got to forage and get as much stuff as you can, and set your world in place so that you can retreat back into the hiding hole, so you can eventually start building up a house above ground.
Oh my god,
it's friggin' fun, and then everything gets more and more elaborate. You get access to more and more things. You dig deeper to get to more interesting materials, to get to your iron, your gold, your silver, your nether, whatever the crap.
Your nether regions?
Your nether regions. So
you start off by burying yourself alive to survive overnight.
Yes.
So that you can unbury yourself and bury yourself deeper the next night.
Exactly. Yeah. And
so, I call that Thursday.
Dudes, I'm telling you, I had no idea the risk reward system of like, well, I got to venture across. Okay, I went to the top of this mountain and I can see across the way there's some sweet materials that I want. Can I get there and get back to the safety of my hidey hole in time? Well, okay, well, what I'm going to do, I've got to plan ahead. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to build a large beacon. I'm going to like build sand up into a tall tower so that I can see where my hidey hole is from far away so I can get back to it. So I don't get lost in this world, right? So I better put a torch at the top because at night, it's going to be dark, so I want to see my torch. And the brilliant thing about the lighting in this game is you go underground and it's dark, and you can throw torches up on the wall and build sconces. I like building sconces in my... So anyway, so Alex and Dan and I started a server, right? And the three of us are playing together.
Oh, I didn't realize that you could do this.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And you can invite people to your server. It's pretty cool. So we are all playing together. Division of labor. Like, we build... We find a really good place to make our hidey hole. We start building our house on top of the hidey hole.
Is it called the hidey hole in the game?
No, that's pretty much our. That's okay. In the parlance of our times.
Okay,
right. It's like a safe room. You build the safe room for the house.
You
first.
Have to build the safe room first, dude, or you will not survive the night. Telling you.
By the way, it's like we've talked a lot about like not surviving. What happens if you die in the game?
You lose all the crap you accumulated. You also gain levels if you do combat. You gain levels. I'm not really sure yet what the levels get you,
but it's not super punitive.
No,
because you could always go back and obviously
you can collect all the forage, you explode into it. A pile of the crap that you were holding, and you can collect it if you find it again. But I felt a real desire not to die, but it does.
No one wants
not.
To die in a game. I was just wondering how punitive it was when you die because there's a lot of time going into this, and I'm starting to think, man, if I got punished very hard by dying here, it would be really frustrating.
But it's so great, the relationship. Everything makes sense. Everything, like where stuff is in relation to other things. Like if you find a lava stream, usually that's where the more important ore will be, because that's kind of how it really happens in the real world, you know? You can deform and reform water areas. Anyway, we had this amazing – we are building this amazing house with an awesome balcony, and we decided, oh, we're going to connect the hidey hole, because our hidey hole got pretty elaborate. We were excavating, and as we were excavating, we like opened up into a chasm underneath the ground.
Okay.
Where, you know, it's not just like all not just all solid ground. You can like find a whole huge chasm where there are bad guys underneath the ground.
Oh,
as
really?
Well.
Okay, that's cool.
Are you mocking me?
No, I'm mocking you at all. I think that that's actually genuinely cool.
Last time I saw Jeff like this,
Skyrim.
No. I think this might actually trump Skyrim a hair. This is the World of Warcraft craze.
Well, you understand why people get so into this, right? I didn't understand it, and now I do. And
but finish your story, because
we connected our underground world with our above ground world. We made a huge ladder down into our awesome cavern, and so we're building an underground dwelling, and then we have like a trap door up into the house. So it's like this amazing, awesome treehouse.
You made Bruce Wayne's manor.
Yes, dude, it's freaking rad. It is so rad, and it allows for so much creativity. And you know, the thing that I assumed And where it really differentiates itself from something like Lego is you sit down with Lego and you either have an idea or you start building, but you're building with the pieces you've got, but you're building sort of in the abstract. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
You can either follow the instructions of the set you bought or you can just start building something. Here, you have the ability to do that, but you're also dictated by this environment that already exists. So you have sort of a two-way street of inspiration. You have the idea that you what you want, but you also have what you discover. And I didn't realize the discovery element would be so fun, to be honest. Of like, oh, we found this huge chasm, so now we're going to make this into this nice area, and we got to clear out the monsters down here, and oh, dude, wouldn't it be cool if we had this here and that there, and let's do it, you know? And there was a whole moment where I ventured too far away from home and I got lost and the guys were like, come back, it's getting dark, where are you? Oh, we gotta close up the hole. And you know, so much fun. It's so much fun. And the game is moddable, so you can like change the sort of low res textures into all that. People have done these amazing texture packs and you can make the game look pretty darn good, and the draw distance is really spectacular.
Right.
I highly recommend you guys give it a shot. I was super skeptical, but I'm hooked.
I think
hooked.
I think it sounds like we made a lot of assumptions about what the game is, the same way that we did with Demon's Souls before trying Demon's Souls, where you hear a lot about what people are doing and you just assume that that is all the game is.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the stuff that I've ever seen for Minecraft are just like people created, you know, internet memes in Minecraft, and it's like, okay, I guess it's one of those build block games. Like, I didn't know there were different elements to it. It sounds really interesting. The question that I had with you, we were talking about this, Garnet, was, do we now consider Minecraft, because it is now finished and it's been released, is this a 2011 release when we're talking about Game of the Year?
Yeah, I think it is.
Because we didn't put it in 2010's Game of the Year list.
No, it is by the creators declared as out and official
1.0.
and released 1.0 now. So it is a game. Now that's going to be a bigger question about the Old Republic since it's coming out December 20th. But I think that, you know, ethically, because that being an MMO, we're better served by moving into next year. But this game, obviously out 1.0, fully within 2011, and it's been coming for so long and been played for so long that it's more like just stamping it as saying, okay, this is at least the start line for where we're going to launch off and say it was retail. A question about servers. Now, you say, you're running your server, right?
Well, yes.
And so that means that that game only exists when your computer is up and running.
It lives, Alex happened to be the person that hosted it, so it lives on his computer. Mm-hmm. He has to be on, unless he hosts that on a site that will host it.
So that's what I was about to ask. So is this like back in the day, well, not back in the day, like still happens all the time, with dedicated servers for shooters or whatever, where you could hire rack space out of a colo?
I'm sure people do that.
That's supposed to be what a lot of people, I bet the Shackers probably do that.
I'm sure
they do. I stay out of that thread also because I know that I know nothing.
There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of people who just post their IP address
yes.
and you can just hop on and check out the world they made.
How involved is this thing going to be with you in the next few months? What do you think you're going to wind up doing with it?
He wants to know how much more you're going to talk about it.
Yeah. I don't know.
I'm curious I think I'm pretty sure the response that we're going to hear is that you've just plumbed the surface.
That's absolutely the case. Yeah. And there's so many different ways to play it. Like, I've read stuff about people who just like go out to sea and they live their life on the sea. They build a ship and they just live in the sea and they don't even mind. They just harvest the sea, because you have to, like, you build a stove and then you got to put coal in the stove and you got to cook your food and you can, like,
wow, it's really intricate.
It is extraordinarily intricate, but so intuitive. It all works like you would think it's supposed to work.
Didn't Marcus Peterson work on this by himself? Was it just Notch who did it?
It was just Notch working.
And
on
now Mojang Entertainment is
that's pretty insane.
Crazy. I think they've sold 4 million units of the game as well.
Yeah, they do very well with it. Yeah. And it's not that it's $26. It's not.
It's completely reasonable.
Yeah,
yeah.
Reasonable, and obviously well supported because you're going straight to the developer who was working on the game.
Yeah, and I don't know if we mentioned a while back about Audible and how I was listening to Ready Player One,
right?
You know, which is basically a book about like the ultimate MMO, like a guy invented. You know, there's a lot of science fiction books that are about this, but it's about the virtual reality. There's one virtual reality that everybody on Earth uses, and we all hang out there. It's like Minecraft kind of feels like the closest we've ever come to that, because it really is what you make of it. And you can make anything of it. Now, you know what I mean?
Now, is your player and your what you've created and what you found dynamic in the sense that it follows you, or is it always living just in your one world that you've created? Like, if you now go and play on another server, will you have the materials that you've found from your original world?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I'm not going to say anything because I don't know either.
Yeah.
It would make more sense to me from a game system standpoint that once you had created a character within a server, that it lived in that server, and that you started, you know, if you did another character, you do another server, it would be a separate thing. That would make sense to me, but
again, in the MMO sense, that makes sense. But then there's sharing between that.
So let me ask a question, Jeff, let me throw this out there. You know, we look at questions all the time off of Twitter as well as in the official thread at shacknews.com. @TylerCulp had thrown one to us this week that was, can you play a game wrong? Mm. And which, you know, it's an interesting question. Obviously, it feels a lot of debate, but I think that this game, ironic that you brought it up, because this game really illustrates the idea of there is no wrong way to play a lot of games, especially a game like Minecraft. I mean,
yeah,
there's no what would be the right way to play this game. The right way to play the game is whatever makes you survive,
follow your fun,
live.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that, you know, you said it has like this great appeal that's building to it. How much of the appeal do you think stems from that there's not a line in the sand that says, here, you guys are playing it the right way, and here you guys are playing it the wrong way?
I don't know. I think that kind of thing can be as off-putting as it is attractive. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? I think for some people, that's really attractive. And other people, it's like, I don't know what I'm doing. Tell me what to, you know, I don't know.
Right.
If there's no right way to play it, then there's, you know.
Yeah, some people need an end game in order for
it
to be.
There actually is an end game.
Is there an end game?
Really?
Evidently, in the 1.0 release, the big thing they introduced was a thing called The End, which is like you fight this dragon in the netherworld.
Is the dragon called Bethesda Lawsuit?
I don't even know how you get to that point at this point because the real win for this game, the next logical step for this game would be better AI from the bad guys mm-hmm. and more customization for your guy. Like, I really think the graphics are charming and I like the customization of them, but having the NPCs and your player character be more than blocky and really have character and behave in interesting and unpredictable ways rather than sort of just walking towards you, you know.
You don't think that would be disruptive? Because I agree. I actually think it's really charming. I can look at screenshots of Minecraft all the time, especially because so many of them are elaborate and like crazy, awesome yeah, creations. Yeah. But I've always thought, wow, this is really cool bit art in and of itself.
It's always sort of it never appealed to me, because whenever we write about the game, and we write about it a lot on Shack News, is we use the same 4 screenshots for our header images. And so to me, it's always like it's the game that constantly looks like it never changes. You know what I mean? Like,
can you capture some screenshots for us, Jeff?
That's just
sure.
That's just the editor in me, where I like, that's what I'm fed. So that's why it's all I see. So it really colors my perception of what it is.
I know you guys want to see my hidey hole.
We were doing really well.
What? Talking about my hidey hole. Just talking about it.
Well, how about that, folks? We got right to the end of the first segment, and then the pig arrived.
Exactly. I do want to see. I want to talk about. I'm going to try it. I'm going to go home tonight. I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to play it. We're going to talk about it again. But I want to know, because I know that you love the discovery of games, if a month from now, next year, you still are enamored with the discovery.
Very good question. And I wonder that myself, if it becomes a little stale, like, oh, this is now work. Because it mm-hmm. totally could be. Mm-hmm. But I think I would love you and I to play together.
Okay.
Or at least, I'm worried about you jumping in by yourself, because having
you
somebody
think I can
like
handle it? What is this?
Well, that first night is fucking hard. It's not
He'd
easy.
Like to let you in his hidey hole.
Where's the hidey hole button? Create hidey hole.
Oh, you might need a.
Because you
got
to get to work right away when you start. Because that sun is going down, bro.
You really might need a safe word.
That sun is going down, bro.
You guys didn't even know from Minecraft.
All right, before the show goes down, let's take a quick chance to regroup. When we come back on the other side, we still have all kinds of stuff to talk about, including Nathan Drake and this plumber named Mario, who's both riding carts and adventuring in 3D. Stick around. We can confirm. We'll be right back. Dave Del Rio bopping out the bit music or whatever, the 8-bit music. Chip that was tunes. Awesome. Chiptune stuff, dude. He told me yesterday, he's like, okay, I got to go work on some mixes because people asked for some new beats. He's like, I got this thing I want to play with. I'm like, all right, cool, cool. That's nice. Very good stuff, dude. Well done.
Yeah.
Hey, obviously.
I'm waiting for the Stanky Dick remix. Sorry. I was trying to think of how can I bring that up again for the 9th time.
Oh, Lord. Hey, lots of great stories obviously going to be coming out of Minecraft. We're going to resurrect a little thing that by popular request that we did several years ago on the One Up Yours show. Actually, Zab participated in this.
Yes, before I was even in this industry, really.
This is our holiday stories sharing. So if you have a story that relates to, you know, somehow to video games and Christmas, holidays, Hanukkah, or, you know, whatever you're celebrating, send them in to us. Well, actually, don't send them in to us because we don't really have a mail we check. Put them in the thread on shacknews.com for the show. And we'll be start pulling those together over the next week or two. We're going to record our holiday show on December the 20th. So you've got, you know, a week or two to remember them and, like, put them down in words and, you know, Don't feel the need to embellish them. We'll embellish them for you. This is just a little quick example. Zavs, what was yours?
When you guys did it, John read a story that what happened to me was my parents bought me a Game Boy Advance, a Game Boy when it first came out in the 80s, 89, I think it came out. And I unwrapped it very precisely and played it for a while and then was startled by noise and put it back in the packaging and closed it up. The next day when we opened the presents, I had realized I forgot to turn it off. And my parents realized it with me, and I wasn't allowed to play it for 2 weeks.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, and they thought a miracle happened.
No. My parents did not think of it.
Playing Game Boy.
They knew better.
I like how he wasn't allowed to play. Son, you're not going to play your Christmas present for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Very strict European upbringing.
That is kind of funny where it's like, opened that early.
They
you
knew.
You don't get it at all.
I was notorious for that when I was a kid.
The spirit of giving only happens at a specific time.
We laugh, but it's sort of scary.
Yeah.
So it is Christmas season, and that means that we've gotten past the new releases coming week in and week out. It's time to start catching up. I used the Thanksgiving holiday to start getting into Uncharted 3.
Hey.
I must be pretty close to finishing it because I'm way further ahead than when I talked to you last.
You're
post ocean liner?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think that's where the game really starts getting great.
He's sort of the desert part where it starts to get a little more bogged down.
Well, just because you have to fight. If you didn't have to fight, it wouldn't be so bad.
So you don't want to fight?
I think the fighting is where the game suffers, personally.
See, this is interesting. So as soon as I put out there that I was doing it, we were talking about a lot about narrative and stuff. And then last week I talked in my video question of the week, which if you're not watching, you should be watching our videos on the Weekend Confirmed YouTube channel. About how we seem to be very quick to judge video games, and had a lot of great response to that. And among them was Amy Hennig, who's creative over at Naughty Dog on the Uncharted series. And we started a little conversation. We're going to come back to this after I finish the game, but without, you know, I hate to be like potentially offensive to the dogs because I love them. I love what they're worked on. I think Uncharted 3 is uneven, and the reason I think it is uneven is because it seems to be at the height of really struggling with this push-pull between what Amy described as an authored story, which
right.
I think is a great way of putting
well,
it. Like an author,
yeah, that's
authored story
phrase.
Is that I'd like to like. Mm-hmm. I'd like to submit that we should start using this term in game design because it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
If we're not already, like authored story versus players' interactive control in a game, mm-hmm. and the places that this most gets in my face are the dramatic chase sequences.
Really?
Yes. And I'll tell you why. Because the chase sequences to me, and this is also, so again, this is part of a conversation I was having with Amy, so I don't want to take, you know, undue account for this idea, is that it's the struggle between stuff that used to would have been just a pre-rendered scene. It would have mm-hmm. because it's part of the narrative you want to tell, and now you want to give the player some control. So mm-hmm. that they feel like they're really engaged with the character. However, you still want to have that authored presentation and that authored element to it. That what happens is that, so for instance, early in the game, there's a place where you're in a chase and you're running around rooftops.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to include who it is or where it is. So if you haven't played the game, I won't spoil it. The trouble with this chase sequence is that there are a number of blind corners, and oftentimes the camera even pulls around to where you're running into the camera for dramatic effect. It's great. It makes it look cool as hell, but it also turns it into... You're just basically dragon's layering it. You're learning by, do I go right here? Do I go left here? Do I jump? But do I turn right?
What most games do in that situation is just give you a QTE.
That's true.
And I give them a lot of credit for not falling on that crutch, because at least I'm still within the game systems and at least I'm still playing the game. Yes, there are the fail states are too frequent.
Yes.
And too limiting. I wish it would be like, well, I can go left or right here and the game branches. That would be much more dynamic and interesting.
I think that would be really tough.
I think it
tough,
doesn't.
Indeed.
In that particular level, what you're talking about, there's one instance where you have to sort of turn, you have to jump left off a ledge where the camera sort of pulled really far back. And I think that that is an instance of the design of the game and the narrative not working together very well. Because what ends up happening is you don't realize that that's the specific route you need to take.
Yes.
Because every single other moment where you've had to make a decision like that has sort of been a straightforward line.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of, and once you make that jump, the sort of that level ends and that's sort of the end of it. But it's a problem where they're not communicating well, I don't think, in terms of, you know, the game design versus the narrative of what they want Nathan to be on at a certain position in order to start the next scene, but they don't do a good job of actually telegraphing that or showing you exactly where you need to go.
But the problem is that the way most game designers solve that problem, or not most, but unfortunately some...
Often is solved.
Yes. Is that you'll have a glowing ledge or you'll have some sort of thing that sticks out from its environment. And that's...
Enslaved.
Enslaved.
Yeah.
Very good example. And that is... I find equally unsatisfying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
However, the problem with this specific scene is that if you run forward, you can actually run forward into sort of another area. The design, the environment design of that specific spot sort of got lost in the shuffle, I think, because it doesn't do a good job of indicating that you're supposed to jump off this ledge, because you can't see over it to see that there's actually something to jump to.
Right.
It's just sort of a blind jump. And the problem is there's no like, they could have put a flower pot in the middle of there so you know, okay, I can't go forward, rather than, you know what I mean? Like, they could put something that makes sense in the environment without adding an invisible wall.
But then they're back to guiding you. Then they're back to putting you on rails.
The entire thing is a guide, though. If you make a wrong jump there, you die. Regardless of giving you control of that particular situation and not being QTE, they are essentially guiding you.
Oh, no, I agree.
You know what I mean? Like, it's
how much of a veil of illusion is there that you're actually in control versus being on a rail?
I think that because the rest of it is so guided and so like forward thinking that when you have to make that blind jump, you're just like, it makes no sense to you at first. I mean, I failed the first time because I didn't realize I had to make that jump off the ledge into darkness.
Two things come to mind, and keep your thought. Two things come to mind. Number one, I think that there's a tacit admission by them that this was a struggle, because I've never played a game that quick saved so rapidly.
Well, I think that's to the game's credit.
And I agree.
And it also takes a fraction of a second to load. You're not sitting there on a loading screen, which is what would be absolutely infuriating. Yeah, I think there's a direct correlation between how long I load between when I die and how frustrated I get.
I have a low frustration tolerance for this sort of stuff, and they have not broken it once, because even when you make those mistakes, the reload is so fast and you literally lose never more than about 30 seconds of gameplay. And you know what? That's great, except to me it's still just it's more like the Band-Aid fix than the underlying repair.
Yeah.
Number one. And then number two, something I was just thinking about, and it's funny, it's like Zav and I both recently went to Disneyland. Stick with me for 2 seconds. This will make sense. And unfortunately, you didn't ride Magic
Not together, by the way.
why not?
Hand in hand.
You didn't get to ride Magic Mountain.
I did not.
Which is unfortunate.
Magic Mountain is a different park. You mean Space Mountain.
Space Mountain. Sorry, you didn't get to ride Space Mountain.
No.
And I've ridden Space Mountain before, but I had never ridden Space Mountain in the very front car. Like front of the very front car. And we rode Space Mountain in the very front of the very front car. And it just sort of, a light bulb went off in my head as we were talking about this guided thing.
It's on rails, though.
It is on rails. And one of the things that they do, and this really shows you how much camera positioning in this case, just your eyes, but could be also in a game camera positioning, and environmental cueing can really be used to guide someone's experience. Because one of the things that this ride does really well when you're in the front seat, you really pick up on is you think you're about to go left and suddenly you're lurching to the right and you have no idea where you're going. And you're like, man, I was sure. Like, your brain is so...
The Indiana Jones ride does that, too, because I was in the front car of the Indiana Jones ride, and there are a lot of spots in that ride where we're now talking about Disneyland, by the way.
No, but it's all the same thing. It's all the same magic trick.
Yes.
And the magic trick is inserting in an authored experience, inserting the perception of surprise so that you feel like you made this discovery or you made the choice or you did the unexpected thing that resulted in an unexpected situation happening. Yeah.
I think it's the insertion of also of trying to make it seem like you are quick thinking and you are the one who made that quick decision to jump left rather than keep going straight.
Exactly. Right. And that's if you had done that really the first time, you would have thought, oh, this game's awesome.
Exactly.
But unfortunately, you didn't do it the first time.
I think because there are certain elements that they do not cue you to, so you're not aware of where you should or what will be a fail state or what wouldn't be. I mean, this brings back the can you play a game wrong? You can play that section wrong because they have an exact route which you have to take. And it's a great cinematic experience for you to go through that authored experience. However, if you don't do what they want you to do, you have to start again. And you may have to start again 3 seconds earlier, but you do have to start again because it's not what they intended for you to do.
Yeah, ultimately, you can't play it wrong.
Exactly.
The thing that I'm kind of coming to right here is as I'm thinking about this particular moment and moments like this later on in the game, is that chase sequences on the whole are quite difficult to
do in
games. And I'm thinking of how mind-numbingly, controller-throwingly frustrated I have been getting trying to do some of the chase sequences in Assassin's Creed Revelations, which is so stupid. And they don't need to be in the game, and I hate how quickly you can lose. And the same thing for some of the early GTA games where you would have to keep up with someone or, you know, and they make a right turn down the street and you miss that and you're screwed. You're just screwed because you can't possibly turn around fast enough. And I don't know the city well enough to be able to loop around. And he got away.
So you went through something very quickly there that to me is one of the linchpin points here is that you don't know the city well enough. And here's what because I've been thinking about this a lot because I really like the idea of chase sequences because they're really dramatic and they are exciting. I think that to pull one off organically, the only way you can really do it is to have taken the player through the environment in which they will be chasing and have given them enough
information
and given them enough time not only to have familiarized themselves with it, but somehow through the design, you have to make sure that you've taken them to key spots so that they understand the geometry and the geography such that when they come to that right, left, straight turn, they know where they wanted to go. Because that was where they wanted to go. And the thing that came to me to mind as I was doing this was, remember Burnout Paradise?
Mm-hmm.
Burnout Paradise was all about, you were still in great chase sequences. You were in cars, you're doing great chase sequences. And if you played Burnout Paradise very long, there was initially it was really challenging. But what happened was because you were always driving around the same city and because the missions were really smart about driving you through parts of the city over and over, but coming at it from different approaches, you started learning the landmarks and you learned what the landmarks looked like from different places. And then you started to learn what streets were underneath them. And you learned, oh, that's right, I can get onto this highway here. And then from this highway, I can jump onto the railroad tracks here. And from the railroad tracks here, I can make a hard left and be up in the mountains.
It
is a process.
And it's a tough thing to apply to a game like Uncharted where
it is.
You're moving through location, and you're always progressing forward throughout the world.
Exactly.
The game that occurs to me, it's not really a chase sequence, but it's done extraordinarily well, is the end sequence of Halo Combat Evolved, and then they reprised that again in Halo 3, I believe it was, where...
Escape.
And the reason that works so well is because I'm not on a set path. There is a most efficient way to go through this set path, but I'm encountering problems and problem solving on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And while, believe me, there was a number of times where I died, I never felt like I died because I didn't do the quote unquote right way. It's because I handled the situation. It's the same reason I died, you know, in a firefight in that game. I handled the situation ineffectively. You right. know?
Well, you know what? It's almost like a Sonic game where there's like three rails in front of you and there's yeah. obstacles and you just have to jump from rail to rail to rail.
Yeah.
It's just in this case, they're all with pretty texture maps and Covenant right. in front of you and you have to pick who to blow up.
But you feel, I felt in that situation more like I was in control oh, yeah. of what was happening rather than being controlled by a set pathway.
Yeah. Though there are moments where, like, you know, there's certain parts of the ground that are going to fall and you won't be able to drive through those.
Right.
Like, there are cutouts throughout that stuff, but you do have much more choice to it. I'm remembering the Assassin's Creed Revelations chase, one in particular that really frustrated me, was because I kept trying to chase this person that you're trying to catch up to by going through on the roofs, and the game doesn't tell you that you actually have to do it from the street level. You know what I mean?
What? Terrible.
There's a part.
It's terrible. It's so
frustrating. And I failed that part many, because what happens is the person runs away and you see them go up the ladder and they're really far away. And by the time you start running towards a ladder or to get up a building, it ends and yeah. you didn't catch them
instantly.
In time.
Instantly. And all you're chasing is an icon.
And here's the thing
them.
That bothers. And here's the thing that
oh,
bothers
so
me about that game is built upon the fact that you are inside this virtual world. So those icons make sense, I guess, within the context of this character would see these things. If I can see the icon of where he's going, what does it matter what my proximity to that person is?
Exactly.
That thing that bothers me the most about chase sequences like that.
Yeah, I think you guys just fail. You just took. So you started off talking about mechanics, but now you're also saying that it's broken because of fiction. So the problems with that scene seem
well,
to be
Well, I think
that's
a tangential argument about the fiction.
And I've made this argument a lot about how and we just talked about it, there are narrative parts of games that do not mesh well with the gameplay design yeah. of them. And that is one of the things that bothers me
I think
most.
Mechanics is the major issue here.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think he was saying, I could explain it away even, you know, but the mechanical problem with that is you just fail and you don't know why you failed.
Yeah, because...
And that's the worst kind of...
Because they give you no indication of how you were... See, that's the thing. It's like, go chase that person. But now they've added another element of like, this is how we want you to chase that person. And it becomes way too excessive.
So I wanted to talk about combat and hand-to-hand a little bit. But since we talked about narrative there for a second, one of the things that stands out to me, because I really, there are a lot of parts of Uncharted that I really, really still love.
Oh, yeah. It's a fantastic
game.
And
one of the part that's amazing to me is how casually fucking amazing the story delivery is every element from you know, virtual acting to just the voice part to camera and scene setting, and just every little piece of it is so casually good that it's like I feel guilty because I'm almost taking for granted that it is delivering to me what I would say is easily a cinematic, like feature film quality dramatic presentation in the context of the game.
Yeah.
It's smoking amazing.
Without spoiling anything, there's a certain moment where someone leans on someone else.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know anyone that has played that game that doesn't remember that moment so clearly. And why are there not more moments like that in video games?
Well, Naughty Dog makes a very strong case for hiring your voice actors to do the actual motion capture and actually filming that stuff.
Yeah.
So they have that performance capture versus just motion capture.
Amazing.
It's an argument that I think they make very well for the rest of the industry to pay attention to.
But you could do that all day long if you didn't have writing.
Sure.
It's the writing.
It is also, but it's also, and a moment like that happens in the third game where these characters and these actors have worked together and know those characters and they understand the tics and they understand all the little nuanced like things that those characters would do. How they walk, how they talk, the mannerisms, all that stuff matters when you're trying to tell a story, especially a story that sort of tries to give the lineage and the history of, you know, this world and these people.
Yeah.
One thing that, you know, games don't typically do very well.
Yeah.
So without spoiling things, that leads to my next thing that I'm unsure about and I'm worried about the longer I get into this game, which is that I think that it's a knife edge proposition to humanize Drake as much as they're humanizing him, and especially to bring up his character flaws as strong as they want to bring up his character flaws. Because we've seen in the prior two games, this guy who is, you know, is ultimately a video game hero, not a dramatic movie hero. He has a body count that's into the thousands by the time you get to this game, and he's saved the world and dealt with supernatural insanity. And this, you know, this obsession to a point of dramatic character flaw piece is really hard to communicate out of that character. I mean, it's almost heading towards wanting to be like a Greek tragedy, but he's already such an odd character, or not an odd character, but he's already such a larger than life, superhuman, amazing character that trying to make him the centerpiece of that to me is a bit, it's throwing me off a little bit. I love the leaning on part, like that part, amazing. I love the characters. I love the way they flesh out his, you know, relationships with other people. But then I am struggling a little bit with this Drake not being exactly the Drake I wanted him to be or thought him to be, which is it's certainly my personal problem as well. And maybe I should be challenged. Maybe it's great that they can challenge me like that.
I don't really follow exactly what you're saying.
I mean, the only way that I could try to clarify is by spoiling something that happens. But I think one thing that we even talked about when we did the review on TRS, Jeff, was that it's difficult to sort of forget the fact that this is a dramatic storytelling of you know, one bunch of characters, and then remember, oh, and this, to get to point A to point B, you have to kill hundreds of people.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's, I mean, if you want to compare it to Indiana Jones, I don't know what the body count is in Indiana Jones, but it's never.
He definitely kills some dudes.
He does definitely kill some dudes, but
it's not shooting them in the face with a gun.
You know what I mean? And that's where I think where it's, do you think that they were forced, even when they were designing this game to beginning in the beginning, that even though they want to tell a narrative story, that they were forced to put these situations in where you would have to shoot.
Remember, they've said this a bunch of times. I've talked to Amy about it a bunch. Like they set out to make an action game. They did not. No one forced them to put the shooting mechanic and guns into it. That's the game they wanted to make. They wanted to make an action game. They wanted to make an action hero game. And they've always had. I mean, that's why they always had an arsenal of real guns. And it wasn't just here is a generic machine gun. It was here's a bunch of different guns, and the guns have different characteristics. Like that's always been a part of the game. That's not by force.
Yeah, and I guess if every Indiana Jones movie was 8.5 hours long, he'd kill a bunch more dudes. You know what I mean? There's that problem too.
It's just a timing issue.
Exactly. They're just getting ramped up at the beginning of an indie game, and like Drake, man, he's got to take on entire armies. So now he has hand to hand. Which I'm sort of, I originally thought I would be in love with, but the more I use it, the more I feel like it's a crutch.
It's just more, it's more counters than anything else.
It's unfortunate. And I said this with another game that doesn't come to mind, but the juxtaposition of this to Batman, it's unfortunate also because I think it even highlights how not up to snuff it is in comparison. You know, and my biggest complaint is, you know, I'm sure you've experienced this up to this point where you get, there's the big guy, the larger guy.
The brute.
You have to fight hand to hand. If you attempt to shoot him, he just knocks your gun out of your hand. Yep. And that fight happens the same way every time.
Saints Row the Third.
Yeah.
I mean, sadly, you know what I mean.
But back to the other argument we were making. At the same time, we have to say, big applause for Naughty Dog for not taking the QTE route for these things because you wanted to have that fight in there.
Of all the moments in the game, that is the most like a QTE, those fights, because it's like triangles on the screen. I got to press triangle.
Okay, you're talking about that, but I'm even talking about I can use hand to hand now as a combat alternative throughout the game,
and that you could in the previous games as well.
But it's a lot more thought out now.
Yeah,
and there's a lot more to it.
I mean, I thought you were always more successful in the second game because in this game it seems like they just counter you a lot more, and then while they're doing that, maybe that's all they shoot at you and they shoot at their friend. they don't care who they're shooting at.
Oh my god, that is so annoying.
The one thing that this was my question of the week:
toss a grenade at your feet while you're like fighting
your buddy. Yeah,
exactly. And my question of the week this week was about do developers need to do a better job of, with AI? And I think that if you look at something like Halo. You know, the AI is very reactionary. It looks at what you're doing, and it looks at your positioning, and it sort of reacts to where you are and tries to do a better job of flanking you and taking you out because you were sort of, they are predators and you were the prey. In Uncharted, in you know, modern warfare, Battlefield, all these games that have, like single player stories in those games, it's always the same thing where it's, let's just throw more dudes at you to kill you. There's no strategy. There's no real AI. And if you play Modern Warfare, you die a few times. You realize that they're always going to spawn out of that door, and they're always going to come at you this way. And they're always, you know, it's not dynamic.
And the Uncharted guys have this extraordinary ability to throw a grenade exactly at my feet.
Yeah. Of course. They're very good.
They're very good.
They play a lot of horseshoes in their off time. Yeah. They're very good on the horseshoe field. All right, that's some Uncharted talk. We might come back to it. I'm going to finish it up, obviously, over the probably tonight, because I'm really close, and get on to some other stuff. We're going to get on to some other stuff when we come back, like Mario. So that's what you got to look forward to when Weekend Confirmed returns. Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by the Gamefly app, the must-have app for gamers. The app is filled with game information, the latest gaming news from shacknews.com, and videos and screenshots for over 8,000 games. New version 2.0 for the iPhone and iPod Touch includes cool new features like social interaction. Now you can follow and interact with the crew from Weekend Confirmed in the Gamefly app. Check out what Jeff Cannata, Del Rio, and I are playing and saying about the latest games. And as always, the app is free and available now for the iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices. Still lots of discussions probably to be had about storytelling. Shadow the 13th had an interesting comment in the Shag News thread last week. I'll just rock this out here real quickly, and I think we'll just leave it then as a kicking off point to continue the conversation. And we'll talk about some Mario afterwards. I feel like Skyrim's storytelling is hit and miss. Sometimes when characters are standing on the spot, spewing forth monologues and exposition, it's awkward and boring and long-winded. It's just a bit clumsy and bulky, and I don't think stationary people talking is really a strong way to deliver a story. And some of the script is a bit silly or ridiculous. Games with focused cutscenes do a lot better job at conveying powerful story and narrative. However, where Skyrim really shines and rises to a place that linear-style video game stories cannot tread is in the world, the ambiance, and the atmosphere. And then he goes on in his explanation to talk about some of the just organic things that you see going on and hear conversations happening. And they, you know, ultimately, if you interject yourself, usually there'll be a quest or something that evolves directly out of all these things that are just happening in the world. Then he compares that to Asheron's Call. He did that again.
God, wow.
Damn it. To Assassin's Creed.
He did it in the office earlier.
He was a big Asheron's Call player, you know. He was a level 40.
It says Assassin's Creed is like a rope. It has a beginning and an end, and you know where you are along that experience. It's clear and powerful and effective. It has a deliberate beginning, middle, and an end, and it hits certain beats and twists in the proper order. The world of Skyrim, however, is more like a tapestry. There's no clear line. It's full of little threads dangling in front of you that are entirely optional and dynamic. You choose which threads you want to follow or ignore and where they lead you to.
I think it's well said.
And I don't know how we find a middle ground, and I don't know that an Uncharted or an Assassin's Creed could find a middle ground.
But well, I mean, it's obviously much more open in Skyrim. But the difference, I think, is, you know, there is, if you're going to just do the main quest, there is a beginning, a middle, and an end in Skyrim specifically. You may not like the way that the story is told versus other more structured games, but that exists. And in Assassin's Creed, there are side quests and people you can save and things you can do that are not related to the main story that you can actually do as well.
Tapestries. Show me your tapestries.
That's an Indiana Jones reference.
I mean, I guess it depends also on whether or not you patched Skyrim to 1.2 or not.
Well, before we go there...
Backwards Dragons? Man, shit, that is a quest I want to play.
Just real quick on his point about, like, stationary talking as opposed, you know, standing and staring at someone. You know a game I don't think it's enough credit for being innovative in that way? No One Lives Forever.
Okay.
Do you remember what they did with dialogue and camera angles?
I love Kate Archer and No One Lives Forever.
Me too.
Like not,
you and me are on that same page.
Preaching to the choir.
But specifically, I mean, the dialogue was clever and funny. But aside from that, just how it was shot, quote unquote, no game really was doing that at that time. And I think...
So explain what piece you're talking about. You're talking about the surprise dialogue where you would overhear people and
speak up on them?
Or are you talking
about... No, I'm talking
the,
about...
The fact that you're like walking through environments and there's talking...
When Kate would like engage in a dialogue sequence, not just the ambient dialogue, but when she would... a cutscene, basically, it was shot in a way that was much more cinematic than other games were doing at that time. And I think that wasn't... cut scenes per se that was more interactive than that. Am I wrong?
I'm trying to remember what a cut scene in that
I
game
think you
was
could
like.
Couldn't you interact and pick your dialogue options, or am I crazy?
I think you're crazy.
Anyway, I remember the game being shot really well as far as like shot reverse shot and having movement and it being staged more like a film than most FPS games were doing at that time.
No, I think that is true. I think that was definitely one of the pieces that came across in it. Their level design was really good for that too.
That's a great series that should be resurrected.
It was a great series. I'd love to see Hubbard work on that again. So yes, of course, if you're playing Skyrim and you've been worrying about your tapestry, it might be unraveling a little bit. Patch 1.2 came out for PlayStation 3 on Monday this past week, and then they went ahead and dropped it on PS3 and 360, I mean on PC and 360, despite the fact that it has some issues. You might have heard Zab mention backwards flying dragons, which occasionally happens,
that's
evidently.
That's a feature, not an issue. Feature.
The bigger problem seems to be, the biggest problem actually would be that magic resistances are essentially broken. And while they may not have done a lot in the first place, for high level players especially, that can result in like some pretty tough
going. If you just get one-shotted or two-shotted suddenly because your magic resistance doesn't work, poisons work on vampires, all kinds of crazy stuff. There's also a bookshelf problem where you can't pick books up off of bookshelves.
This is all created from the patch?
This is all created from the patch, yes. The patch.
Too bad.
Well, you know, I mean, I think probably part of what happened here is that there was a tremendous amount of pressure. This patch, by the way, was for PS3 to address the memory leak that would cause frame rate to really die as you played for more than an hour and the save file grew. And for 360 to clear up the, if you installed it to your hard drive, muddy texture thing. And then some boot problems with PC where they were having like just inability for it to boot, drop to black screen. And I think they were under a tremendous amount of pressure to get those items fixed and get it out. And again, back to that same thing about, you know, I was talking about last week in my question of the week. Like, it's QAing this game, it must be an unbelievable nightmare.
Yeah.
Unbelievable nightmare.
But that's, you know, that's not an excuse.
No.
I don't think that they can hide behind that. And
I might have held, I mean, I think it's probably tough. Like, the 360 patch might have been tough. The PC patch, I might have just held it.
Mm-hmm.
So, good news is, though, they're doing a interim fix for next week. So, next week, we should get the update to fix 1.2.
Yeah.
And then that's the last patch until the new year. So they're not going to do another patch for Skyrim until after the new year. So we better hope, you know, keep
crossing. No new
fingers
problems.
Crossed yeah. that they get everything fixed
no
there.
No whammies. Stop.
Sideways flying dragons.
Yeah. Where does that go from there?
Yeah.
Hmm. So, you know, it's good of them to be pushing so hard to fix it. And I am jumping. I'm going to keep jumping all over the show plan. Because Skyrim is obviously a game that not only will we have a lot of patches for, but there's obviously huge potential in DLC. Mm-hmm. And Marty PG-13 brought up this subject of how much DLC is a good thing. And I can remember John Davison and I talking about this a long time ago even. But Marty PG-13 says, I bought a lot of DLC, way too much, but I'm starting to become exhausted by it. Are we in danger of oversaturating DLC and turning gamers off the concept due to the overload from titles such as U-Star, Rock Band, anything Capcom or Namco related? Is it becoming too much? And then I'd add on the next phase of on these big games. Now we're seeing, you know, obviously we'll see a lot for Skyrim. We have Shadow of Ram coming out for Gears of War 3.
Right.
We have packs literally for every game, extending those games. Are we going to keep playing those games in lieu of playing the next new release? Do they take away from the next new release? If so, or, you know, how does that dynamic begin to work?
I don't think it's in danger of becoming too much. I think DLC on the whole is so easy to ignore. Should you not want to pay attention to it? And should you want it, I think it's more is a great thing. As long as it's quality and it, you know, it gives you value for your dollar, I think it's a great thing. And I certainly don't think people are not looking at the newest, latest, best because they're still playing the old stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. So
the only time where it does become sort of a nuisance is if you're playing a multiplayer game and that DLC is multiplayer focused, and then you realize you're not able to play with your friends because they have content that you don't.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like, I do like single player DLC. I bought all the DLC for Oblivion, for example, and Assassin's Creed Brotherhood, and I played through that stuff because I liked those stories and I wanted to continue those stories. And those are really just an extension of that brand, so that company can continue to work on the next thing. The problem is, there was a report a long time ago where Microsoft said that in order for your DLC to really be successful, it needs to release within the first 60 days the game is on store shelves or something.
I remember that.
You know what I mean? Something along those lines. But that's why people were saying that the Grand Theft Auto DLC that came out with the 360 exclusively wasn't as successful because it took like a year for it to come out. Whereas, you know, even Rockstar has said Grand Theft Auto 5's DLC is going to be a little bit smaller so they can release them more frequently. There's a lot. I think companies are seeing the benefit of releasing high quality DLC because now what they're doing is trying to sell you these season passes where they sell you this promise of, hey, we are going to give you all of this content if you buy the season pass. Whereas when I interviewed Danny Bilson, I said, if Saints Row 3 is not successful, this is before it came out, and people pay for that season pass, are you going to still release that content? And he said, like, if no one buys the game, we're not going to release that content. So if you bought that season pass, it's not as though you are going to get a refund. You paid for what you were promised. And you were promised to get a certain amount of content.
Well,
eventually what happened with that situation is they outlined exactly what you would get.
Right.
But there are other companies that have not done that. You know, Forza said you were just going to get our monthly releases, but how many releases does that mean? Where are the stipulations? Where's the fine print? You know, there's a lot of this sort of goes hand in hand with the online pass situation, which is getting really muddy.
It's probably a good thing I didn't buy that three pack of Half-Life 2 episodes.
No, but you just wait. You're going to get it for a bargain. I've already paid for that. Yeah. In 2022, when it comes out, it's going to be amazing.
You know, it's funny. I remember, like, last year, though, Bioshock 2 had Minerva's Den. And remember, right. Alice was super
I'm still want to play that. That.
It's supposed to be amazing.
Everyone who talks about how great it is, I just haven't carved out the time.
And that was it's a good example of a game not being successful on a specific platform and not getting DLC. I mean, Minerva's Den was not going to come to PC, but eventually it did because there was an outcry for it. And look at Battlefield Bad Company 2. Yeah. The DLC for that stuff never showed up on PC, the Onslaught DLC, and that was due to server issues and all this other bullshit. But that's a thing where, you know, it becomes sort of a problem at this point where now not only do you have to worry about, like, what is the DLC going, what are the DLC plans going forward, but am I covered? Did I buy it on the right platform? Mm-hmm. What are the deals that they've made beyond this? I mean, some of that shit is kind of ridiculous and bullshit. I mean, the Saints Row on PS3 was supposed to get exclusive content, and it eventually didn't get the exclusive content. So it's just like, there's a lot of, the problem is everyone's learning as they go,
mm-hmm.
and there's no roadmap for it. It's sort of when DLC first came out with Mech Assault, and they started first charging for DLC eventually. No one knew what there was no preset plan. People were kind of going as they were learning as they were going along.
I heard you can get the roadmap though if you pay like 800 Microsoft points.
Yeah. Is that how you get it?
Yeah.
So there you go.
The two GTA 4 add-ons, I think, stand as great examples of excellent content that came out post-release. They weren't really too worried about the timing. The right. thing there though is that game was so big. How many people, you know, we talked about it before, like how many people actually finish the game, then how many people go play it. Yeah. Then though, I finally have hit my first one where I was like having to have the DLC because Ariel and I finished Borderlands co-op and like it was a no-brainer. Like we were immediately like, we want to play more of this game. Mm-hmm. And we bought Claptrap's New Revolution right away because it's like, oh, I love the Claptraps and that's fun and want to spend more time in the world. So like a little light bulb went off of like, oh, this is when it works. But, you know, I've played plenty of games that had DLC to them and not gone and gotten them. But I don't think we're in danger of burning out. I think we're not in danger of burning out because the upshot of all that is that the DLC particularly works for the person who is the core player that really enjoyed it. But then the game has to, like Danny was talking about, has to develop enough of a core audience to be able to support that and keep going it long term. The 60-day thing kind of stinks, though, because, I mean, look, like Borderlands is 2 years ago and but the content's there. Content hasn't gone anywhere.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
there.
I think a lot of companies have proven that they don't need you to follow that roadmap.
Yeah. You know, another
I
one
like
that's...
roadmaps, apparently. Sorry.
You do like roadmaps.
Well, I'm just thinking of Burnout Paradise. I mean, there was a year's worth of DLC that came out with that game.
Yeah. But then look at how they did with Hot Pursuit, and they gave away too much stuff, and like Hot Pursuit just sort of fizzled and went away, and it was such a freaking good game.
Mm-hmm.
I loved Hot Pursuit. Like, such a great game. Switching gears, or staying in the same subject, Mass Effect. We just found out that a mission from Mass Effect 2 that didn't make it into Mass Effect 2 is going to be in Mass Effect 3. Now, this is...
Oddly, it's getting another person into your party to deal with the problem in Mass Effect 2, so it makes no sense at all anymore.
Well, it's a little strange.
Silly.
I'm not upset. So the mission in question, the plot line in question, we don't really know a lot about it. It is though a return to the Citadel, which is the giant space station that around which the first game happened, and that's a big deal. Like I would definitely have been upset if we got through the third game and I never got to go back to the Citadel because it was fucking awesome and it was a really important part of the original part of the journey, and that would have been a bad thing. I'm intrigued that it became part of the third game. I'm curious as to what we think about this idea of, well, content that didn't make it into a second game can go into the next game because, oh, we got a trilogy and that gives us a second chance. And how come it just couldn't have been a DLC part? You know, why couldn't it have been a great DLC adventure?
I think there's a lot of assumptions that you're making there as far as on paper, the way that sentence is written is, this was done. We didn't put it in this game. We threw it in that game. I seriously doubt that was the case.
I don't think it was finished.
I don't even feel like it was. I feel like it was like we had designed out this idea for this thing that you could do with the Citadel. It didn't make it into this game, but you know, you can do it now in this, you know, we liked the idea, we carried it. I'm sure there's a million things that
right.
in every game's sequel where it's like, oh, we couldn't put that in this game,
yeah.
but we have time now to put it in this game. We've yeah. been wanting to put it in for a long time. I think that that's kind of the natural
design process. It kind of sounds like, you know, obviously they had a design for what their DLC was going to be, mm-hmm. and this was a part of the original game. It didn't make it into that original game since they already had a design for their DLC. Instead of scrapping it entirely, they just threw it into the next game.
Yeah, and it also sort of is representative of the organic nature, the way a narrative can develop across a trilogy like this as yeah, it's in production. Because right. the game's away, you know, my initial thought was, well, I don't think Tolkien was sitting there in the midst of the Two Towers deciding, oh, I'm going to cut this, but I'll put it in Return of the King.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, George R. R. Martin talks about that all the time. There's several chapters that he ripped out of Dance with Dragons that's going to be in the next book.
Right. And then know, I thought, so. And then I thought, well, that's a matter of perspective, because my perspective is that I read the three books after they were already completed.
Right.
I wasn't there I wasn't reading the first book and then, oh, I'm waiting for the next, oh, here's the next book. Oh, now I'm waiting for the next book. It was just purely perspective. He might well have done that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we, like, what does it matter? Because ultimately he had scripted out where things were going, where the character arcs go, what's going to happen. And if this Citadel scene was an important part of it, then it's cool that it's going to have its spot in the overall arc of 1, 2, and 3 and not get left out.
Yeah.
And it's clearly important if it's not selected as an optional piece of DLC, because you never have to play the DLC in order to get the full story. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So we got a few more minutes in this segment. I'm just keeping up, since we've been bouncing around a lot. We talked a little bit about Burnout Paradise and how much we enjoyed it. We talked a little bit about Hot Pursuit and how much we enjoyed that. Bad Wolf Chicken posed, great name, huh? Bad Wolf Chicken.
It's his Christian name.
Posed an interesting thread in last week's show 30. He said, why aren't racing and sports games seriously considered for Game of the Year? And I that's an interesting question, because I pushed very hard last year to have Hot Pursuit considered. And, you know, I mean, that notion didn't play very well amongst the Shack staff. And I mean, part of it was because, and I think, and this is where I would start the conversation, is that racing and sports games, and I would say racing is a subgenre of sports games. Sports games are innately tied to your fandom of the real world sport. And if you're not a fan of the real world sport, then it's really difficult to have an appreciation. And before you say, well, if I don't like role-playing games, I don't like role-playing games, it gets a little more granular than that, because a sport game is not just a sport game. It's a FIFA game about football, about international football, or it's a Madden game about NFL football, or it's NHL about NHL game. It's not just a sports game. It's super particular.
Yeah. I also think there's something about games which attempt to simulate something that already exists in the real world that feel less
creative.
I wasn't going to use that word, but it's yeah.
No, that's the valid argument.
Part of what I love about games are, you know, they're really well designed and crafted stories. And you don't get a really well designed and crafted story out of playing games of NHL 12. You might get an anecdote or a tale mm-hmm. to tell a friend because you played, you know, the two of you played and there was a great match. But that's not something that you'll get the same way of, you know, playing a BioShock
mm-hmm.
or, you know, even playing matches or even playing multiplayer in like Call of Duty or Battlefield. You know, there are different stories to tell that way. But I mean, yeah, I think there is this lack of creativity sort of. And also it's an annualized thing. It's a cycle that we sort of go back to. And I know that there's going to be some people saying, well, isn't that what Call of Duty is? But, you know, it's a different situation, I think, where if you look at a game like Hot Pursuit, that does lead to maybe contending for Game of the Year, because that is something that is a narrative driven story. Sure, it's racing, but that I think is different from like a Grand Theft Auto or Gran Turismo or Forza. You know what I mean?
Hot Pursuit less so than The Run. I mean,
sure.
And I would say The Run is not that great. So, you know,
no danger in
game. But maybe that's there. Maybe that's because the fiction isn't that great. Maybe that's just because it wasn't pulled off that well. You know, I think about some racing games, and I don't know how you do this. I mean, Madden has sort of toyed with this before with, like, you know, you create your own superstar, right? Mm-hmm. That sort of inject yourself into the game a little bit more personally. And, you know, you saw games like Pro Race Driver Series used to have, you know, the narrative of you building a racing career and building up. Ridge Racer 4, R4, one of my favorite parts of it was that it had the cool story part to it. But it is really difficult to make that work, because really the focus of the game is not the story. The focus of the game is the out on the road driving, or the on the field playing.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though, but I think that Gran Turismo has been in the discussion for Game of the Year.
Now, Gran Turismo certainly has. Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And
especially
numerous
times. Gran Turismo 2 and, and that was because, though, I think it starts to suffer from what Zan was talking about, of the annualization of it. It's that, the first time that you really take like that big, big, big leap with technology and inclusions and all the stuff in it, that's great. And then it's really harder to come back the next time. For instance, like Forza 4, very, quickly in the public view to not be looked that way. But Forza 3, I think a lot of people might have said, was a really strong contender, because it was a massive revision.
Yeah.
New platform, amazing new engine, fantastic inclusion of cars in it, great social. Everything that they had put together into that game made it a really, really strong package.
Yeah, you're essentially nominating refinement. I mean, they're refining their original.
That's a good way to put it.
You know what I mean? You Gran Turismo, the original, was this iconic thing that came out that would probably be better part of the conversation than, the fifth version of the game that's out now, because they've just reiterated and refined what they've already had in the past.
I mean, I think you kind of jokingly mentioned it a moment ago, Zav, but I think that Call of Duty is kind of the same way in a lot of people's view. It's like not really seriously considered for Game of the Year anymore, just because it's like, it's the next one of these.
I mean, that's weird, because I wouldn't think of it. I wouldn't put it in that category the same way that I would put a sports game in. I mean, I wouldn't consider Madden a Game of the Year candidate versus Call of Duty. That's a weird way to put it. I do understand what you're saying, though. It is a lot of people's perception of it is it's just the next Call of Duty. They might as well put the year on it.
I don't think you're going to see Call of Duty up for a lot of games.
I don't think so either.
I don't think we're going to see a lot of shooters up for it. I think in general, shooters seem to be suffering from some sort of appeal fatigue, at least to the gaming critics, who get a lot of flack from the audience, because rightfully so. You could say, look, some of the most popular and most beloved games this year are shooters. Why are people not talking about them in the Game of the Year discussions? Mm-hmm. I don't see Modern Warfare 3 getting any interest there. Battlefield 3, maybe, but probably not. And the one that's really been forgotten that Zav and I talked about is Crysis 2.
That's my favorite shooter of the year.
And yet, it's really getting hard for a shooter to register a blip, and maybe it's just, is it shooter fatigue?
Hell, I even forgot Portal 2 came out this year.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That needs to be in the discussion for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, that was when I was pressed the other night on the VGA thing. That was what I came through with, because I love playing it co-op. The co-op was so freaking fantastic, and their ability to blow up the idea from just test chambers to an even bigger experience in a full-fledged game was really, I mean, that game blew me away.
And I've said it before, and I know I may be crazy, but I think Bulletstorm needs to be in that discussion as well, if you're talking best shooters of the year. And maybe best games.
Well, last year was very different for us at Shaq News, because we had categories.
Yes.
Yeah.
Whereas this year we don't. We have a top five list with honorable mentions.
That's what we do on TRS as well.
You know what I mean?
Five games.
Oh, you like that? See, we were tentative, but we talked it through, and we're like, you know what? Like, this just gets crazy, because you have all these granular, like, this genre, that genre, this platform, that platform. Well, if a game wins in this
What's
platform,
the difference
do we
between
let it do this?
Adventure game and action game, and it's like, come on.
Yeah, and also we settled on top five because it's like no one really wants to hear, hey, you're the top seven. This is the top seven best game of the year, according to us. It starts to get a little silly at that point, too.
All right, get your shells and banana peels ready, because we're ready to head for the finish line in the fourth segment of Weekend Confirmed when we come back.
Welcome to the party, dude.
It's a really socially awkward party.
I want to listen to some music.
Do you want to ride Erica's horse?
That's what this party is about. We've been having a great time here. Glad you arrived.
I'm glad I arrived too. Music.
Socially awkward.
You got to chill out. Chill out.
No, you gotta do. You gotta do what I do. Just name your character. Your name spelled backwards. I lost. Erna.
Frog. I can't get behind that. I've just heard some things about this, that, and the other thing.
Skinny is terrible.
Chill out.
You should probably name this character Link, but you might want to call him Bobo.
I can't get behind that.
Frog!
Bobo. I heard you cleaned up the College of Magic. Thank you. That's right. Welcome to the party, dude!
Socially awkward party.
But it is a party nonetheless.
Oh,
I'm digging the chip tunes, bro. Definitely. That's awesome. That's great.
We should give Del Rio a little time off often because he came back strong.
Yeah, that's good.
Came back with super mega worm style there. Love it.
Very cool.
Hey, if how long a game is in development has anything to do with its run for Game of the Year nods. You know, if annualization is bad, making a game take 7 years probably would be good. So that should put Last Guardian in pretty good shape then.
I thought you were going to say Duke Nukem should be Game of the Year.
It worked for Two Human Guys, right?
Oh,
I actually like Two Human.
You know, the unfortunate part is there's a lot of fallout to these protracted development cycles. And if rumors out of Japan are accurate, Fumito Ueda may have been the unfortunate victim of how long it's taken to put this game together. I'm sure there's tremendous. Fumito Ueda is the creative force behind Ico, Shadow of the Colossus, and this game, which my head
Last
just,
Guardian.
Last Guardian, which just broke because I was thinking about Team Ico. And see, he worked for Sony. Obviously, the studio is internal there. And it sounds like he's out. And there's probably been a lot of internal pressure on him. And
genius takes time, dudes.
The good news is, if you're worried about the game, that he also, according to this rumor, is staying on in a freelance capacity to finish the game, which I'm sure he will be, you know, even more committed to. Maybe it'll make it better. I mean, he's obviously a super creative guy, yeah. and the production realities of creating a video game are really challenging. I mean, I think of it like the same way, like with the way Gran Turismo became a runaway freight train of like, we want to include this, we want to do this, we want
to
do that.
There's got to be a bigger story than this behind the scenes that we are not privy to. You
know? Think?
I really do think, yeah.
Yeah, some reports indicated that he also was becoming creatively drained and wanted to go do something else.
So I didn't read that.
It would be
that sounds pretty speculative,
right? That's why I said a report indicated that
sources unnamed
sources.
You know, I think that it was really. I think maybe the handwriting was on the wall for a shakeout like this when not only did the game miss E3, but it wasn't at TGS, and not only like wasn't at TGS, but like we have not seen screens or video in forever. And that to me almost smacks of like it's out of favor with Sony or whatever. And if you go back,
could you imagine that game coming out and it not being good?
No,
I can't either.
No.
I can't
go back and watch. Like I remember sitting there in the conference room at TGS 2 years ago when the new trailer came out and he did the, you know, they did the like quick group interview. And like Ueda was so, I mean, still so passionate about it, so committed to it and so earnest in, look, you know, it's a big challenge. We're working really hard. We're gearing up to go into crunch mode. We're bringing in more people. We're busting our asses. We want to make this as awesome a game as you want it to be awesome. I don't doubt him. It's going to be awesome.
So where's the dream destination for him, for you?
The dream destination.
Where does he end up that is like, yes?
I think he's going to go the Inafune route, which is create your own studio and work on your own projects. That's what that report was indicating that he wanted to.
Yeah. Do you think he would benefit from being platform agnostic?
I don't know that would happen, to be honest. I mean,
no?
There's this. I mean, his legacy is sort of with that architecture.
Yeah.
So I think that it meshes really well with.
Well, maybe he
that.
Could
but again,
find a whole
as
new...
a creative guy. How much does that matter?
That's very true as well. However, I mean, we don't know the backstory. Maybe there was a reason for him to become platform agnostic. Maybe there's a reason for him to not focus on the PlayStation platform entirely.
Yeah.
Game creative and game creation are two separate things.
Right.
And I feel like the dream, I don't have a particular dream spot for him. The dream spot would be the spot that has the production systems in place to work with a great creative team to harness that creativity and then turn it into games productively. Mm-hmm. And I can't take credit for this because it was in the thread on NeoGAF. But one that would really be an amazing fit, but I don't see it happening, would be Naughty Dog.
Oh, wow. That's a
because Naughty
wild
Dog's
thought.
Production process is refined. They've proven with the Uncharted license, with the Uncharted IP, that they can build these amazing, fantastic games and put them out on a cycle and finish them and get them packaged and out the door and in great shape.
But is that what you want from him? Do you want him to have that structure of, all right, now it's 2 years later, now we have to have your next game? I think working with a team like Platinum would make a little bit more sense for someone
Platinum
with that.
Platinum gets games out the door.
They get the games out the door, and they also have that creative freedom, and they have a really strong relationships with publishers like Sega and other companies as well. You know, that works, I think, a little bit better for
I don't want someone to say, Ueda-san, we need your idea for the next game, but I would love for them to be a place where he's giving out all these ideas and someone is you know, making sense of them and organizing them and putting them into gamifiable chunks.
What if he went the sort of the Tim Schafer route and was sort of started putting out
micro games?
Micro games.
Awesome.
You think that would be
do you think
that he needs a bigger tapestry than that? Or could he create the journeys of the world? And
I was about to say, it's already been brought up that game company has sort of assumed the mantle in the absence of Team Ico.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
So there you go. That's caught us up on the news that you can use. And you guys have been playing some handheld games. People say we don't play handheld games. These guys right here have been playing the Mario Karts and the Mario 3Ds.
My power went out last night. So what did I do? Grabbed my 3DS.
Unfortunately, it was still charged.
It was.
Amazing.
It was, thankfully. Yeah.
Though that battery does not last long when it's in sleep mode. You've been playing Mario Kart. I've been playing Mario Kart. What do you think of the game?
I've never been a big Mario Kart guy, so you should probably take the helm on this one. I think it's it's fun when we play against each other.
Sure,
although
which we did.
You smoked me. You stopped smoking, but you smoked me.
It's true. All of this is true.
that's really where the fun. I don't curl up with Mario Kart and play against the AI for a good time. That's not
kind of difficult to play the game multiplayer, especially because the game's not out yet.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, and. It comes out December 4th, I think, or December 7th. So I don't know.
You're sure we're allowed to talk about
Probably this Sunday.
Yeah, I think it's this Sunday.
The embargo. You're not allowed to review it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, the embargo's already up on reviews.
Oh, that's
reviews
right. Reviews
up.
Have been up. Yeah.
So the thanks. No one knew.
Yeah, I did not know.
Thank God I wrote this down. But I think that it's what Miyamoto said recently brings true for this game, which is it is a very traditional. You know, sort of callback to Mario Kart, which is not a bad thing at all.
Yeah,
I think that it pulls a lot of great levels from Mario Kart games throughout the years. Even Wii title, Wii maps are in there as well. And I think that it's a lot of fun when you're playing it with other people. But I'm sort of in the same boat as you, where when you're sort of forced to play against the computer, there's not a lot of the competitive edge that I get from a racing game. Even if I'm playing an arcade racing game, I don't get that from Mario Kart playing that single player. I like playing with more people, and the multiplayer stuff that I have been able to play has always been fun because you feel like you're competing with someone who is, you know, at your skill level.
Right.
And you don't get that when you're playing, you know, quote unquote, single player of the game. But there's so much stuff to unlock, and like the characters are really great. And I love
the coins are back.
The coins are back, which are a big, big, important part of the game.
Not only are they back, I really loved that story that we had from the Iwata Asks translation about how coins, they were talking about the design in the game and how coins had oftentimes in more recent Mario
Kart
been added at the end because, we need to have coins in it. But this time they started off and said, hey, we're going to really build a traditional Mario Kart. We have to have the coins at the beginning and really figure them into our race design and figure them into planning everything because they're an important part of the design. They're not just a tack on.
Yeah. And it's... The one thing that is sort of a complaint that I have about it is that once you finish a race when you're playing online and you press back, it's like now you're back in the main menu and like pick one of the three things you want to do, the single player, local multiplayer or online multiplayer. And it's sort of never, there's no direction to it. It's just sort of like, oh, you're finished. Okay, go back. And, play another one. Or you go back. Like it's, I wish that there was a little bit more. It's a little disjointed. And I wish that there were more like, you know, where you can compete on a much grander scale, which is some of the online stuff we're playing with it. There's a lot of options for online. I still need to play a lot more of it because we're going to review it, I think, next week. And we're going to try to hit the review when the game actually does come out.
All right.
I want to wait to play the game online with other people.
What you guys haven't told me about is the most important part is tell me about the carts, tell me about the classes and how they handle and what the driving feels like. Mario Kart is, to me, reductive to that moment of power sliding around a corner, hitting a pickup box, getting the weapon you wanted, using it on the guy in front of you, and getting past him by the next corner.
It all feels good to me.
It feels great, and that's where I think where Miyamoto was saying it's much more traditional than you know any of the other iterations that they've come out with the game. It feels like, and they've sort of created a nice throwback to what I think Mario Kart did really well in the, you know, in the Super Nintendo era. It mm-hmm. feels like that.
Good.
It's
and
not
the nubbin works really well for control. I really like how the what's the name of that damn thing?
The circle pad.
Circle yeah. pad. Okay. I'm pretty sure when we were playing it, I was playing with the D-pad.
Hmm. Yeah. I really like the nubbin.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it controls great, and it's a lot of fun, and it's a great way to like waste time or spend some time playing with people online. It is not Mario 3D Land, which I'm hearing is much, much better.
That's the game I've been playing.
How is
most.
The 3D in Kart 7?
I haven't even turned it on.
Oh my gosh, really?
I have not.
I like it. I like the 3D.
It seems like it would be cool for like the part where you like, you know, jump Mario's kart and become a hang glider.
Yeah,
and...
yeah, it's cool. I mean, a racing game by its very nature is perfectly fit for 3D because you're looking down the field.
Sure.
And
sure,
you can yeah. really get a sense of how far back you are from the kart in
front
of you.
Man, it can make you motion sick as fast as the corners flip around. And, you know, like you have that like very quick changing field of view yeah. in Mario Kart. That feels like it makes me seasick.
I don't have a huge problem with that. The
I bigger, don't get motion sick, but it problem, seems like that'd be weird.
Bigger problem I have with the 3DS in general is that my hands tend to cramp up just because it's a little too small and the buttons are placed a little bit. It's made for little kid hands. I hate to say it, but I think it's true.
I got some mitts in there. I brought
really?
Them, no,
I get that. Trying to hit the triggers mm-hmm. and stuff, it's a little.
But the 3D is lauded as one of the best parts of 3D Land.
I really, really love 3D Land. My God, it's so elegantly designed and beautiful, and the levels change everything up so drastically, and it really takes advantage of the 3D in an awesome way. Yeah, I mean, just the difference in the camera placement. It's such a subtle thing, but it really is dramatic. And the fact that you're jumping such farther distances now, like there's one of the first levels where you get the propeller hat block, and you're zipping up way into the sky, and it's asking you to go through these. They have these gold hoops that give you 5 gold coin value, and you can drop through them and zip way up. And the camera is placed above you and slightly behind you. It's so dramatic in that 3D view. It's really, really cool. And they do so many wonderful things with switching the camera perspective. Now you're 3/4 tilted to the left. Now you're perfectly in 2D. Now you're directly on top. It's always pushing things right at you or having you deal with depth in really interesting ways. And it never has the problem that I had, for example, in Little Big Planet, where I'm not really sure what plane I'm on because the 3D assists with that. And they do a really great thing with shadows and making sure those all visible.
You know, your description sort of reminds me of the ways that I was thinking creatively, you know, how to describe Galaxy, first time we played Galaxy.
Because,
you know, introducing the sphere idea sure. and then moving around the spheres, like really changed things up. And
yeah.
It sounds like it's as much a shift as that.
It absolutely is. And it's so dramatic the first time you get to an underwater level, because here you are, underwater levels in Mario are so familiar. You know what to expect. And here you are in an underwater level where you can really deal in true three dimensions as far as your movement options, because Mario isn't attached to the ground anymore. He can move around in space. And
there's buoyancy.
There's exactly. And the way they handle how the look of the underwater stuff in 3D and how you move through that space, I think is so elegant and really, really the killer app for the 3DS as far as I'm concerned. I dig it. And again, another Mario game where level to level, you're doing such different things. There's so many new ideas being thrown at you. These games are beautiful.
In terms of the design, do you think that it, because I read, it may have been in Iwata Asks, where they were talking about how they were trying to meld the old with the new, sort of melding the old Super Mario 3 style with the Galaxy style. Do you get that sense from the game when you're playing it?
Yes, very much so. I mean, there's moments where you definitely feel the Galaxy influence, but then there's definitely that old school. I mean, my girlfriend picked it up, and the first thing she said was, oh, it feels like the old Mario. And the thing I said to her was, but there's so much new stuff. There's so many new ideas here and completely different gameplay mechanics that you've never experienced before. And she just, it felt very familiar.
That's designer success right there.
It really is. They know what they're doing over there, man, at Nintendo.
So 3DSM saved?
In my opinion, I am so grateful that I'm able to play this game on that platform. Now, whether or not I'll continue to feel that over the next few games that come out on it. And it, you know, one game a platform does not make, but I think it's proof that 3D can be additive to a gameplay experience by what they did with 3D Land.
I wonder how many times they can duplicate that, because
I hope so.
Because if that's the beginning of it, if you know, if they've started, you know, captured,
took them 5 years to make Zelda on the Wii.
Maybe they captured lightning in a bottle. I don't know.
Which I have to play. I got it from Gamefly, the Zelda Skyward Sword.
You have to play it. Dude.
Yeah,
seriously, Zav, play it, please.
I'm gonna play it. Well, I have to play it because Game of the Year contender.
I want to talk to you about it. I think you're gonna love it.
Well, you don't want to talk to me about it?
Well, he'll play it. That's the difference.
Yeah, the reason why I haven't played 3D Land, by the way, is because Garnet's like, I'm gonna play it. Give me the copy. We games. Got.
Are you gonna play Skyward Sword?
I play games.
Play Skyward
yes,
Sword.
I'm gonna play Skyward Sword. Of course, I'm gonna play Skyward Sword.
Hey, we got a little time. Can I just tell you a quick Skyrim story? I know people
hate those.
I don't give a shit what people like or hate. I like it, so I want to tell you about it. There was on Shack News, we have a series of stories called Skyrim Stories, where you can read about some of the things that have happened throughout the games of Steve Watts, Jeff Mattis, and myself. And one of the one that Jeff Mattis wrote was about how he was trying to collect money to buy a house. Because he had so many dragon bones and scales that
yeah, they're heavy motherfuckers.
Yeah, so you needed to get a house.
Heavy.
You needed to get a house 15, to actually put
they weigh 15. Come on.
Super, super heavy. So I decided to do something else, which is instead of saving money to buy a house, I would just get married and use my wife's house to store my things. So my plan was
that's her dowry.
Trust me, you really don't want to do that, because when you get divorced, you lose half of it.
Half your dragon bones. Half Eddie. Half.
Possibly more.
Apparently, Bethesda got upset with my thoughts on the sanctity of marriage, because as soon as I asked the first random person to marry me, or of the people that you're allowed to get married to, which was, the first woman whose heart is contested in Riverwood, in that first town where there's those two guys fighting over her,
yeah,
with the letters, you just ask her to marry you, and then you get discounts at the merchant, and you can use the house.
Yeah,
the merchant.
That's not a good reason to get married.
This is why I got married. Asked her to marry me. As soon as I asked her to marry me, what happens? Fucking dragon attacks the town. As though to comment.
You brought that on yourself.
As though to comment onto what
if
I did.
If anyone has any reason why these two don't get married.
Yeah. And then the dragon proceeded to fuck everyone's shit up. I swear. The entire town fucking got terrorized by this thing. My companion got killed. Aww. In the process. It was my fault because I shot her with an arrow. But I went to shoot the dragon. Listen, don't stand in front of me when the dragon's standing
she
there.
Learn
come
somehow.
On.
Friendly God. Fire will not be tolerated.
Friendly fire will not be
yeah,
tolerated.
Yeah, seriously. So I ended up killing her, and it did not work out well for me. I ended up reloading the save.
Yeah, there you go.
And I did do the thing over again. But I thought it was hilarious that I knew in my heart of hearts that I didn't give a shit about this person and just wanted to use the treasure chests inside the Riverwood Trader House.
Oh,
and as
goodness.
Soon as that happened, a dragon attacked and killed the entire
house,
town.
Dude, come on. It's so expensive. $5,000 is nothing. You got to stop wasting money on horses.
So many horses.
Bethesda, set off the Bethesda karma meter. This karma meter went ding, 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 ding. Bam. Gotcha. Hey, next time the power goes out, if your 3DS is out of battery life and you have candles, you could play Flashpoint Fire Rescue.
Hey, I wish. I'm dying for a copy of that. So, board games. We're going to do a little board. We've put it off for too long. And I wanted to talk a little bit about some games that are just coming out that I haven't even gotten a chance to play that are on my radar. Because, you know, I've talked about games in a way. Somebody was criticizing me on the Twitters.
Never.
Saying that, you know, you talk about,
yeah, sorry about that.
Board games that everybody knows. You know, if you show us some
breadth of knowledge there,
breadth
Buster.
Breadth of knowledge. So, we have E3 for video games, right? Well, the equivalent to that for board games is Essen Spiel.
I thought you were going
to
say it was B3.
The German board game convention to end all board game conventions. It's enormous. Okay. And it's usually where all the big European board games make their
Essen
new
Spiel.
Release. Yeah, I think it's actually Spiel, not Spiel, but I could be wrong, not being German. Anyway, so there's tons and tons and tons of new games, but here are three that are on my radar that I'm really dying to play. The first one is called, as you said, Flashpoint Fire Rescue. It's a cooperative board game. If you've played Pandemic or Defenders of the Realm, we just had a TRS review of Defenders of the Realm if you want to check that out. These are cooperative board games where you're not playing against each other, you're playing with each other, and you're trying to defeat the board. And this is a really accessible theme because you're basically going into a house. The board is a house floor plan, and it's on fire, and you're trying to save people from a burning. You're a fireman.
All right, that's cool.
Super cool. I hear it's really fun. I'm dying to get my hands on it. It's published by the same people that published The Resistance, which I know Zav played.
Yeah, which was a lot of fun.
So much fun. One of my favorite game designers, maybe my favorite game designer, because he has two of my maybe top three favorite games of all time, is Uwe Rosenberg. And he these two games called Agricola and Le Havre. Two of my Le Havre is, I think, my favorite board game in existence. And they're very dense Euro games, but they're brilliant. And he has a new game that debuted at Essen called Ora et Labora, which is supposed to be very similar to Le Havre. And I'm dying to play it. It sounds very dry. You're like a monk and you're trying to in a monastery and you're trying to like convert resources into relics.
Oh, that's cool.
It's very dry. But if it's anything like Le Havre, it's going to be amazing. Dealing with lots of resources, double-sided tiles so that you can convert things into other things. Super cool. Very Minecrafty, actually.
Civilization does that, by the way.
I know. We got to play it,
we
dude.
We have to play Civilization.
But the game I'm most excited about, I have to get my hands on. It's you can't buy it yet. You have to, can only pre-order it. I really want it so badly. One of my favorite movies from when I was a kid, I hope you guys agree, Brewster's Millions. Did you ever watch Brewster's Millions? Richard Pryor film with John Candy.
Yep.
I watched it over and over and over. The idea, it's quintessential 80s movie. It's about a guy who inherits, finds out that his father died.
The baseball scene at the end alone.
Yeah.
I mean.
Finds out that his father, he didn't know who his father was, finds out his father died and left and was one of the richest people in the world. Gives him an option of, he can take, I think like $50 million, or if he spends all the $50 million, he'll get $100 million or something. I don't know the numbers. But so basically, the whole movie is about him trying to waste this money, but he can't tell anybody. And he's just spending money, and he can't have anything at the end of a week or something, or a month or something. So this is a board game based on that idea. It's called Last Will. And the idea is everybody starts with a shit ton of money, and you have to piss it away and by buying stuff. But you can't own anything at the end. I'm dying to play this game.
Can you just burn all the money in the end? Can I throw it into the burning house in Operation Fire Rescue?
You can't destroy anything, and that's the thing that screwed me up so much in Bruce's Millions, because at one point he buys a super rare stamp and then mails the stamp, and I was like, as a kid, I was like, how is that not destroying it? How is that not destroying it? That's destroying it. How is that not destroying it? Anyway, it's called Last Will.
We just stared into the chasm that is Jeff Kanata.
Yeah. I have the same issue. This is totally in the chasm. I have the same issue with the movie Starman. Okay. Do you guys know Starman?
Yes, of course.
There's a scene where he's learning to drive, and they go through an intersection, and they almost crash into a semi-truck, and it's because when he saw her drive, and how he learned to drive was he saw her at a yellow light accelerate, and he thought yellow means accelerate. But it doesn't make any sense that the fucking truck would be in the middle of the intersection if it was only a yellow light. And if he saw a red light, he would have stopped. This thing has kept me up since I was a kid, has bothered me and burned into my brain.
Oh man, I'm sorry. I think we just broke Jeff. Oh shit.
Anyway, board games are fun.
That sounds awesome. When is that coming out, Last Will?
These are all debuted at Essen. I don't know when you'll actually be able to buy. Supposedly it's a November, December release, but okay. Who knows when they'll actually be able to ship, probably into 2012. But I'm hoping that I'll get my hands on them and I can actually talk about playing them.
We can play them on game night.
I hope we do game night very, very soon, sir.
Yes.
We have spent ourselves entirely out of our account for this episode, so it's time to wrap it all up with a little finishing moves before we do the tailgate.
It's the weekend, and it's time for Finishing Moves!
Yeah.
I always feel like there should be a bah at the end of that, but there isn't.
No, that's like, you do it in your head.
Ba-na-na-na-n. Yeah, there you go.
Where should we? You already started. Why don't you start? What's your finishing move today, Mr. Kanata?
Well, hopefully, if you follow me on Twitter at Jeff Kanata with two N's and one T, you would notice that I tweeted about a pretty awesome release on Good Old Games. My favorite video game of all time. No hyperbole. This is literally the game when someone says, "What's your favorite game of all time?" This game has finally been released. Ultima 7 was my favorite computer game ever, has been released on Good Old Games. I can do the intro still by heart.
Avatar,
know that Britannia has entered into a new age of enlightenment. Anywho, I spent hours of my life listening to Please Hammer Don't Hurt Him on cassette on my Walkman over and over while playing Ultima 7. No lie.
Well, we have really looked into the void today. The last 30 minutes, we have completely looked into the void.
But anyway, if you want to see one of the greatest role-playing games ever to be made, check it out. $6.
Yeah.
If you've never played
it. It's the complete edition. You get the Black Gate, which is Ultima 7.
Serpent and
you get
Isle.
The four expansions.
I think there's three.
Three expansions? Yeah.
It was like DLC, but before we knew to call it DLC.
Yeah. Also, go to shacknews.com. It is actually the Moby Games Classic Selection this week. So you can go and tell us your Ultima 7 stories. If you go to Shack News, there will be a button on the homepage that says Moby Games Classic. Click on that and tell us your memories of Ultima 7.
And we're going to we always recap those at the end of the weekend.
Or your lots memories of, you know, MC Hammer albums.
Yeah.
or pants. Zav, finish him with the finishing move.
This is, of course, December 1st, and November has passed, and a lot of people in the office and a lot of people I know have contributed or been a part of the Movember Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, growing mustaches like manly men do. And I just want to say thank you to everyone who has donated or has, you know, spent time growing facial hair and
put in the effort
in service of it. Prostate cancer affected my family recently. I think that it's a great cause. And it's not just a November thing. If you'd like to keep donating, you can. There's plenty of information, and I'll throw something in the Shack News comments for people to take a look if maybe they want to give away some money.
Yeah. Movember can segue right into Decemberd.
There you go.
I can second that sentiment, actually, because my dad just recently completed treatment and is in remission, and it's good stuff. So, yes, thank you for contributing to a great cause. My finishing move, look, I know you guys have been enjoying griefing me for a long time about my ever-aging PC. So the 10,000 RPM Raptor Drive.
Raptor Drive from Raptor Man.
That's his number one single, by the way. I'm pleased.
Boot drive crashed, and look, I've had a lot of problems with this. I have like the fan header on the motherboard's dead, and basically it's showing the fact that it's almost 6 years old. And a little bit before this show started, I ordered Windows 7 Professional 64-bit because that's the beginning of, yes, I'm building a new gaming computer finally.
So you're gonna give us periodic updates on how that goes.
Yeah, so I'm like this. So unfortunately, although you know, you guys may think that I'm like somehow like independently wealthy, actually it's a really tight time for me. So I'm doing this. This would be very much a budget build. Thank you very much to the ever updated thread on NeoGAF of latest PC specs. Shack News and Chatty, we always have people sharing their builds as well. So I'm kind of bouncing between the two. Right now, I'm leaning towards putting my investment in a 2500K i5, and then probably like an inexpensive motherboard because it seems like I can get by there. I'm not dying to overclock right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is like the part that's up in the air is how much to spend on the video card. I think I'm targeting like a 550 range, although there's a brand new 560 Ti that's just dropping right now that seems like it might be a great time to get it. So, and that build's coming together. I mean,
The card I have is relatively cheaper than it was when it first launched too, and it's one of their top end cards too.
So there you go. That's like 550, 560 is mid-range. Like, I'm not going to SLI.
Good luck to you, sir.
Yeah.
May static electricity not infect your fingertips.
You know, as long as you build on a good service, never stand on carpet, and make sure you're discharged ahead of time, you're in fine shape. I used to build them all the time.
Rules to live by.
Yeah, there you go. Rules to live by.
I can't believe he didn't even do that to himself.
He didn't giggle when he said discharge? Is that what you're saying?
How'd I miss that one?
I don't know.
What the hell's wrong with me?
You really got to step it up.
So anyway, if you guys want to berate me or whatever, give me any other suggestions, there you go. Now you know where to hit the suggestion box. Make sure and keep up with Jeff, of course, every day. Totally rad show. Anything, what else you got exciting?
We're doing an entire episode on Minecraft this week. And I'm sure you'll hear more Heidi Hole stories. And among other things, we've got some big movies coming up. This is the season. I can't remember what this week is.
Did you see Arthur Christmas in Toronto in Arthur Christmas?
I haven't, but I hear I must.
You must.
I want to see Hugo.
It's fantastic.
I really want to see Hugo.
See it in 3D.
Is it good in 3D? Okay, good.
It is after Avatar, those are the two best 3D films ever made.
We got to talk about a good 3D theater in the city because there's some bad ones here.
Burbank AMC.
Okay.
You like the Arclights?
Arclight's good. Arclight's, I prefer Arclight for 2D, but for 3D, Burbank AMC.
That's a long drive for me.
I know it's a long drive for me too, but it's the best one.
All right, so that's it, folks. If you're not sticking around for the tailgate, in which
Del Rio has taken the lead from Jeff Cannata, then that's it. That's your weekend confirmed, and we are Ghost.
And we
best exit music ever.
We just won the podcast, folks.
I would like everyone to know he did not know that was coming. He just had that
on the fly.
That's the genius of the booth. Micah in there in the booth today. Brooklyn's out on her birthday festivities, and we don't even miss. Not only do not miss a beat, we drop a beat.
There's some beats.
We drop
that
a beat right there. Hey Jeff, you've fallen behind in the tailgate. What happened?
In the worst possible way. We were 1-1 on Thanksgiving night, rolling into 49ers at Ravens. My team for the lead let me down. They let me down. Let me down. It's tough, dude. It was a tough short week for them going east.
Oh.
It was tough.
There's explanations.
It was Harbaugh. It was the Harbaugh. There's brother versus brother.
There's a lot of respect between those brothers.
Yes. It was tough. It was a very tough loss.
Well, it's all right. You're going to get a chance to pull the comeback this week because, you know, now that you're in the trailing position, we'll make him pick first.
I like that.
We'll make him pick first.
I like that.
Matter of fact, we'll make him pick first on all of these right off the bat. So we're going to start it off with the Tennessee Titans going into Buffalo, getting 1.5. So it's, Dave, if you're ready, it's the Titans plus 1.5 at the Buffalo Bills. Which way are you going? He's going with the Titans, but it's because Hasselbeck's there. That's why he's going. Like, you know, he's a Seahawks guy, so he's going with Hasselbeck. And CJ has finally got it on track last week, like burned it up. So, Jeff, now your counter.
And the Bills are playing like shit.
And your counter is? It's
I'm going to take the Titans
Bills
as well.
Bills at home.
I know. I'm taking the Titans, though.
Maybe you guys are right, but I'm all over the Bills on this one. Although, I mean, I understand that their running game is you know, not like C.J. Spiller, obviously not showing why he was the sixth pick in the draft last year. Like, who knows what the hell's going wrong there. But, man, Fitzpatrick, like, when he gets on, he's on. Bills at home. Bills at home. So, Zav, we have Titans and Bills. Both of them have blue.
Both blue.
You know what?
It's going to be a tough one for you.
Titans are light blue.
Actually, guys, I did a little research before then. And in honor of Balky from Perfect Strangers, I'm going to base all of my selections on the mascots. Titans definitely beat Bills. I'm going with Titans.
All right.
There you go.
All right.
Coming back to our second game, we have an interesting matchup between the Carolina Panthers and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers taking place in Tampa. It looks pretty much like Vegas is undecided here because the Panthers are on the road and they're getting the traditional three. So, Dave, it's Carolina Panthers plus 3 at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
He won last week.
He says Cam can't win. He's going with the Bucks.
I'm very comfortable taking the opposite of that. I'm very comfortable taking the Panthers and the points.
Well, and that and both running backs looked good for Carolina last week. And Cam's like, I'm with you on this one, brother. I'm with the Panthers. Well, you might not like that one, but I'm with you. I'm taking the 3 points and the Panthers. So it's Panthers. You know, mean cats.
Okay.
you've heard of
Cam, I'm going to relate this to another television show from my youth. When you say Cam, you mean Kirk Cameron, right? So I'm going with, which one is he on?
He's on the Panthers.
Panthers. I'm going with Kirk Cameron and the Panthers, guys.
To beat the Buccaneers.
Beat the Buccaneers, yeah.
And then finally, we have the, oh my gosh, are they going to go undefeated?
If you could make a Who's the Boss reference here, it would really help me out.
Well, Mona, Angela, Samantha, Jonathan.
Is there anyone named Tony on the Packers or the Giants? So we've got the...
Do any of them listen to Tony, Tony, Tony?
We have the, can anybody stop them from going undefeated Green Bay Packers on the road on... And honestly, this might be the last... legit chance for them to lose a game in the regular season.
Yeah.
And they're going into the Meadowlands to take on the New York Giants who
are not looking good at this point.
That was a tough loss last week. They
got smoked.
New Orleans was on.
Yeah.
And Manning looked good. Their defense was down. Their defense obviously couldn't.
And they got to live and die by that defense, unfortunately.
So it's Packers minus 6.5 on the road to face the Giants. Del Rio, you get to kick it off. Packers are going to kill him. So I take it you're giving the 6.5 and taking the pack. All right. He's given the 6.5 and taking the pack on the road.
My mind says take the Packers as well. But you know what? I'm going all in on Del Rio going down. I gotta gain ground somehow. Taking the Giants.
Jeff, I have some bad news for you.
You're taking the Giants as well?
Oh, yeah. I'm taking the Giants.
Really? Man,
yeah, absolutely.
You think they're going to win straight up?
I think they're going to win straight up. I think that the one weakness that the Packers have shown is their secondary. And this comes from someone who is not an Eli Manning fan at all. He is playing a great season. Eli is having a really, really great season. He is throwing the ball well. He's getting it right where he wants. Victor Cruz has become a great complement in that offense with Hakeem Nicks. Like, those guys are on.
It's not like New Orleans has a great secondary either. I don't know.
And if the defense at home, instead of on the road, can rally.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Then I think the Giants can do it. I think they're going to do it. Giants straight up, but I'll take this 6.5 anyway. So Giants or Packers, Zav?
Well, remembering back to Laverne and Shirley. Weren't they doing work at a packing firm or something? They packed boxes.
They were
boxes.
In Wisconsin,
no,
they?
They worked at a beer brewery.
It was in Wisconsin,
don't they pack
right?
shit? Don't they pack that shit up? I'm going with the Packers. Laverne and Shirley.
And, scientific and method. Just, there you go, folks.
He just bit his palm like squiggy.
All right, so there you go, folks. We will have the recap next week, and we'll bring you another fantasy football recap next week as well for the Weekend Confirmed League. Thanks,
before,
to you guys.
Before we kill it, though, quickly, I brought Jeff Cannata to a hockey game, first NHL hockey game.
I went to there.
And it was a lot of fun. The Leafs and the Ducks. The Leafs won.
We went down to Anaheim. We went to Honda Center, and I saw some hockey. It was awesome.
You witnessed some hockey.
I really.
The Ducks should have eaten the Leafs.
No.
They didn't.
It doesn't. Come on, guys.
It was fun.
It's a sport. What are you guys talking about?
It is a sport. I can verify that. I was there.
Oh, very gosh. Fun. And I had a lot of
thank
good...
you, Zav. It was fun.
It was a good time.
All right, everyone. Thanks for sticking with us. Thanks for sticking with us, and we'll be back next week.